Now, to help us in our journey from Scotland back to Scotland, I've produced two maps here, reproduced two maps. This is a particularly useful one, the one that outlines their journey. This is important to have with you because otherwise you might be quite confused, all the places and names and so on, some of which have changed in Europe, and the configuration of the nations have changed as well. That will help you understand where they are. One of my concerns about the paper today, apart from the fact that I am sad to be here because John J. Murray has been ill and I've replaced him, the other is that I hope it doesn't take as long to give this address as it took these men to go on their mission of inquiry to the Jews in 1839. The ones who were earliest home were 6 months, and one of the four of the deputation didn't arrive back in Scotland for a year. So I might still be here next school. The way we're going to go is, first of all, I'm going to deal with some of the background of the Scottish Presbyterian interest in Jewish mission and evangelism. In Scotland, in the post-Reformation period, there always seemed to be a real concern for Jewish evangelism. No doubt the reasons for this and the enthusiasm varied. For some, the Bible teaching was clear, while Paul was especially set apart for a mission to the Gentiles, he still had the conviction that the gospel first be taken to the Jews. Romans chapter 1 and verse 16. His policy, wherever he travelled, was to seek out the synagogues of the Jews in the first instance. And we have this in Acts, in various places in Acts, Acts 13, 14, Acts 14, 1, 17, 1, and 18, 4. And this was motive enough for exercised Christians to seek the conversion of the Jews. Others had a belief in the widespread future and gathering of the Jews in terms of prophetic expectation, based largely on the interpretation of this passage which we read in Romans chapter 11. In that connection, it is only fair to say that there have been varied views among Reformed theologians in that matter, some supportive and some others who do not hold that view. That, however, is not a matter which I'm going to take up or discuss in this paper. So far as the standards are concerned, the 1645 Directory for Public Worship encourages prayer for the conversion of the Jews, and the larger Catechism, question 191, speaks specifically of the Jews being evangelized, that is to say, being called. Now, in 1809, a group of evangelical ministers and men founded a society called the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. And this was an agency which became a link in the chain leading to a concern for the Church of Scotland in the late 1830s to pursue Jewish mission work on their own. In the 1830s, there was a growing concern that Scottish support for mission work among the Jews should be channeled through the church rather than through non-denominational societies. And a leader and pioneer in this was a Church of Scotland elder, called Presbyterian elder, called Robert Wodrow, whose dates are 1793 to 1843. And he was committed both in prayer for the conversion of Israel and practical engagement with them in personal evangelism, taking the good news of salvation through the Messiah, through the Lord Jesus Christ, to them personally. And it was Wodrow in 1838 who moved a memorial in the General Assembly of the Kirk that led directly to the establishment of the Committee for the Conversion of the Jews. And as a result, a large committee, what church but a Presbyterian committee could produce a committee numbering 80 people. 80 people were on the commission for the conversion of the Jews. And that is very impressive. It is very impressive, whichever way you look at it. But this committee was appointed by the 1838 General Assembly. And the focus of the work contemplated was, quote, to collect information respecting the Jews, their numbers, condition and character, what means have hitherto been employed by the Christian Church for their spiritual good, and with what success, at home or abroad, for the advancement of the cause. And this would determine, this committee would determine where such work would be concentrated, making all due allowance for political and other social factors that might impinge upon the effectiveness of mission in these various places. And this was thought to be, quote, the first act in which any Christian church as a church has expressed her deep interest in and her earnest resolution to promote their salvation. So turn to the Commission of Inquiry to the Jews as appointed by the Church of Scotland in 1839. Now, the concern for Jewish mission work, first of all, the seriousness of the Church of Scotland, or the Church in Scotland, in Jewish evangelism in 1838 may be gauged by the organisation of lectures on the subject by various mission ministers. One such series of lectures took place in the winter of 1838-39, and these were subsequently published under the title A Course of Lectures on the Jews by Ministers of the Established Church in Glasgow, 1839. Now, of this book, one writer has commented that towering above every other reason for engaging in mission to the Jewish people, gratitude to Israel emerges as the pivot upon which the whole project turned. A similar lecture series was held the following winter, 1839 to 1840, after most of the deputation had returned from their mission. This was held in Edinburgh, and these lectures were published in 1842. And the name of this book was The Conversion of the Jews, a series of lectures delivered in Edinburgh by ministers of the Church of Scotland, produced or published in Edinburgh in 1842. And in this book, in an introductory statement, Dr. Alexander Black, Professor of Divinity at Marshall College, Aberdeen, and one of the deputation that went on the mission, was to write this: the obligations under which we are to the Jews are such that we can never sufficiently repay. We are indebted to them as the chosen people of God for all the spiritual privileges that we enjoy by the possession of the records of divine revelation. It is but equitable that we should consider what we can do for the descendants of those whose ancestors we owe, to whose ancestors we owe so much, and as the greatest boon that we have, the means of conferring upon them, is our duty to take every measure that can give promise of success, to impart to them the blessings of the gospel, that through our mercy they may also obtain mercy. It is perhaps not insignificant that in this missionary venture, that it occurred at a time, incidentally, of spiritual revival or renewal or awakening in the church in that third decade of the 19th century, under the leadership of Andrew Thompson and Thomas Chalmers. And these men lent their considerable weight in various ways to Jewish mission, which I can't go into. But Thompson especially, was influential through the editorship of the Christian Instructor before his lamented passing in 1831. But for anything to be done practically, of course, there had to be funds raised. And in the event, substantial funds were forthcoming on appeal. Meantime, in decisions about where to locate and plant Jewish missions, various centres were proposed. This is subsequent to the 1838 decision of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. Aden was considered, India was considered. Aden as an area where there were Yemenite Jewish community of some 200,000 souls, we're told. There were many European locations suggested, besides an obvious field in Palestine and the Middle East. So it was decided to await the report of men deputed to go on a mission to the Jews from Britain through Europe, through the Middle East, and back through Europe. And this missioner of inquiry was approved and launched, literally launched, by the group of four men setting sail from Dover on the 12th of April, 1839. The deputation, There were four men appointed to go. Robert Woodrow was one, Dr. Alexander Black, together with Andrew Bonner and Robert Murray McChane. At the last minute, or more or less at the last minute, Robert Woodrow fell ill and he was replaced by Dr. Alexander Keith, who was the minister in St. Cyrus. He had been the minister there since 1816 and the author of a remarkable bestseller of the day called this Evidence of the Truth of the Christian Religion Derived from the Literal Fulfillment of Prophecy, particularly illustrated by the history of the Jews and the discoveries of recent travellers. They didn't believe in sharp little sound bites for their titles. That was produced in 1823 and went through multiple editions throughout this. And indeed, I believe you could still get it if you go onto a digital print to order website, or Amazon for that matter. Of the men selected, two were or are still well known in Reformed circles, obviously, Andrew Bonner and Robert Murray McChane, and both were to celebrate their birthdays on this trip. Incidentally, Bonner celebrated his 29th birthday and Robert Murray McChane his 26th. It was quite an adventure for these men. The other men were lesser known and older men. Black was the eldest at 50, not very old by today's standards, and Keith was just a couple of years younger. Now, Alexander Black was an outstanding linguist and academic of the party. He had been born in 1789, which, as you know, was the year of the French Revolution and the rise to power of Napoleon. It's interesting to fit it into that perspective. He was a native of Aberdeen. He had been ordained when he went into the ministry in Tarvis in 1818 and served that congregation until he was appointed Professor of Divinity at Marischal College, Aberdeen, in 1832. Though he wrote nothing of any great note, by reputation he was an extremely competent linguist. Thomas Guthrie said of Alexander Black and John Duncan, Rabbi Duncan, he said that they were so proficient in so many languages, ancient and modern, that they could talk their way to the Great Wall of China. Well, Alexander Keith himself wrote of Black that he, quote, was the strength of our mission. This may come as a bit of a surprise because nobody knows anything about Alexander Black, but Keith said of him, he was the strength of our mission, a man of vast erudition and a profound theologian, who spoke 19 languages and wrote 12. Okay. What am I doing here? What am I doing here? Black's linguistic ability was to be a boon for the mission of inquiry. Keith, Alexander Keith himself, as we've indicated, was a late replacement for Woodrow. He was the least competent in languages, we're told. And he could not apparently converse articulately in Hebrew, unlike Woodrow, who could. But it was on the basis of his tremendous interest in prophecy and in the Jews that was the motive for putting Keith, Alexander Keith, in there. He was the son of a minister of the parish of Keith Hall, Aberdeenshire. He had a bit of an aristocratic connection, did Keith. He was born in 1791, the same year as the birth of Michael Faraday and the death of John Wesley. Keith was a prolific author, especially in the matter of fulfillment of prophecy. And it was his evidences of prophecy and his passion for Jews that told in filling the gap left by Woodrow's withdrawal. So Andrew Bonner and Murray McChane were the other two in this group of this deputation. And they are well enough known by us that I need to elaborate on their suitability for the mission of inquiry. They were young men, as you know, of distinctly evangelical spirit and were competent in languages, not least in Hebrew. And it's owing to these men, Bonner particularly, and McChane, owing to these men that the whole venture became so well known on account of their narrative of the trip. And this became one of the best known travel books ever published. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that. One of the best known travel books ever published. For the greater part, it was written by Bonner. Besides being an acclaimed source, this book, Narrative of Mission Inquiry, an acclaimed source of statistical, historical, geographical and social information about the Jewish communities wherever they went in their journey. And it was published in 1842 and went through multiple editions. It was like Evidences of Prophecy. It was a bestseller of its day. So let's turn to the experience of the deputation which left these shores in 1839. Robert Buchanan, a bit of flowery Victorian prose, later summed up the whole venture well. He says, "In that year, the venerable Dr. Keith, the modern apostle of the circumcision, accompanied by the heavenly-minded McChain and his other estimable colleagues, were sent forth to gather tidings of God's ancient people and to bear to them the unwanted news that the national Christian church of an ancient kingdom had turned her heart towards them." So thirdly, the experiences of the deputation to inquire about the prospective centres for Jewish evangelism. First of all, the account of their journey. I'm not going to give an account of the journey. Their account of the journey was their narrative. For the details of the journey, these intrepid inquirers, and they were intrepid inquirers, we are almost entirely dependent on their notebooks and subsequent narrative of Bonner and McChain. One recent historian has written that little or nothing of Dr. Black's and Dr. Keith's researches are to be found in print. No letter or report containing their thoughts on the suitability of Pest as a mission station was ever published in its pages. And yet one of the party was to say this. Bonner himself said later, he said with reference to the unfortunate fall of Dr. Black from a camel in North Africa, he said, "But for that fall, our fathers in the deputation," a lovely description of the older men, "our fathers in that deputation would not have sailed up the Danube on their way to Vienna, and Pest would not have been visited." An interesting point. Interesting point. Well, the travelogue compiled by Bonner and McChain is entitled "A Narrative of the Mission of Inquiry to the Jews from the Church of Scotland in 1839, first published in 1842. And if you've all read it, I might as well stop at that point, because you'll know as much as me. Several things come over strongly in the narrative. I'm just dealing with this account as a narrative. First of all, it was written in an engaging, popular vein, recounting incidents and observations in a realistic, if anecdotal, way. Secondly, it's laced through with scripture references, so much so that the Home and Foreign Missionary Record recommended that people read the narrative with an open Bible in front of them. Thirdly, it's a full of objective presentation of facts and statistics, balanced by, says one writer, personal impressions, observations, and passionate opinions. Fourth, there are perceptive comments, apparently, on Jewish religious beliefs and practices, with, quote, "a sympathy for what they perceived to be the Jewish people's inestimable loss of their own spiritual destiny, their own spiritual heritage." Then fifthly, there's a clear compassion going through this narrative of compassion for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. For Bonner and McChain, the material poverty of the Jews in Jerusalem, which they found, symbolized their spiritual condition. Quote, "If we could have looked upon their precious souls, their temporal misery would have appeared but a faint emblem of the spiritual death that reigns within." And this is followed by a wonderful note of compassion. "May we never lose the feelings of intense compassion towards Israel, which these few days spent in Jerusalem awakened, and never rest till all the faithful of the church of our fathers have the same flame kindled in their hearts." Then sixthly, there's a clear convictions of truth evident, not least in the nature of the gospel and its claims upon sinners, including the ancient people. There's notable care over the Sabbath. They were clearly disgusted, for example, by what they found in Paris soon after they'd begun their southward push. quote, "We soon found that buying and selling and every sort of amusement were the chief occupations of the people of France on the Holy Sabbath." So what's new? This is what it's like here. And it is sad, and it should burden our hearts. Then, seventhly, they were zealous to spread the word. And that not just among the Jews. Wherever they went, they took with them, you see, piles of books and tracts and booklets and a whole load of Alexander Keith's Evidences of Prophecy book as well. I'll come to that again. But they took a whole bundle of these things. And one incident in France exemplified this, I think, although it has its amusing side. Driving away from Bar-sur-Aube, near Troyes, forgive me if I don't get the pronunciations right, this is in the way south in France towards Dijon, in the coach, horse-drawn coach, of course, no public conveniences like trains or aeroplanes or anything like that now, then. As they were going along the coach, the Scottish ministers threw leaflets to the French out of the window to people on the streets and in the fields. Bonner and McChain started this, but they were joined by Dr. Black, who, in throwing tracts to the people in the field, said, "Voilà, un petit livre pour vos enfants." Naturally, they didn't just throw tracts. They put them in people's hands as they went on their way, wherever they went. So, again, the narrative shows that how these intrepid travellers had an impressive array of languages. French, Italian, Latin, German, Yiddish, Romanian, and also Arabian, Hebrew, and Greek, of course. Mm. Now, their felicity in such things is staggering by our standards. Mm. When I think of myself, you gentlemen are perhaps far more articulate than I am and more linguistically competent than I am, but when I think of it, there's an example here in Dijon when they were making their way. McChain says in a letter, he refers to a conversation between Dr. Black and a priest, because they met with Roman Catholics as well. They were evangelizing everywhere. Dr. Black, says McChain, and he, the priest, immediately entered on discussion in French. I tried to prolong the conversation in Latin. It makes us feel very inadequate. We might be conversant with computer languages. We might be conversant with texting, in text speak, Pidgin English, but by the standards of these men, our culture is somewhat impoverished. Well, that's a comment. So that's a few comments about the account of this. Let us think of the journey. The journey. First of all, this is in three parts, this part of the talk. And the first is this. The journey from Scotland to Palestine. Now, as to the route taken, you can look at your map and have a look, but you won't get the first part. Black, Keith and Bonner went from Glasgow, and they made their way down the West Coast route to London, where they met up with McChain, who had set off from Leith on the East Coast route. After a pause in London, they finally set off from Dover, as I mentioned before, on April the 12th. That is to say, 1839, for France. They arrived in Boulogne a few hours later and made their way to Paris in time for wending their way through Troyes, Dijon and Lyon, heading for Marseille, from where they were due to take a boat for Malta on the 21st of April. In the event, they didn't make it in time to Marseille and rerouted to Italy for an alternative service boat to Malta. But that took them into some difficulties, not least with the Roman Catholic authorities in Italy. But all along, wherever they stopped, efforts were made to contact Jews, obtain information about Jewish populations, witness to Jews in various places and the areas through which they passed. They were not slow to use tracts, books, scriptures to engage people about their souls. And it is all very impressive and moving. Sometimes their spirits were buoyed, at other times they were frustrated in encountering suspicion and opposition and obstruction to their progress. And this is what happened in Italy. They had gone to Leghorn via Genoa, and immediately they started to distribute tracts to the men who handed their who handled their luggage and other bystanders, and this attracted the attention of customs officers. And Doctors Black and Keith were marched off to the police authorities. They were subjected to a grueling interrogation. They were told their books would be sent for evaluation to the censors in Florence. And whilst waiting the decision of the censors, they didn't even start their journey on the mission to the Jews yet, hardly. Whilst they were waiting the decision of the censors, the men met with Jewish leaders. There was a significant Jewish community in Leghorn. Perhaps some 10,000 souls were told. John Ross, in his book Time for Favour, comments that the rapport between the travellers and the Jews in Leghorn was enhanced by the harsh treatment that they had received. The Jews seemed to recognise that these Protestants were equally the enemy of the prevailing Catholicism as the Jews were. But when the censors' decision came back, the tracts were returned to them, but not the copies of Alexander Keith's Evidences of Prophecy. They were all impounded, apparently because they contained views at odds with Roman Catholic dogma. So the travellers observed the unusual providence, quote, that in seeking the lost sheep of the house of Israel, we should meet with treatment at the hand of the oppressors, fitted to awaken in us the cry, how long, O Lord? So the deputation finally set off from Leghorn, 3rd of May, sailing to Malta. They sailed from Malta to Alexandria via a Greek island called Syra, modern Syros, arriving in Egypt, Alexandria, on the 13th of May. It wasn't that their mission began there, of course, but they were certainly faced with a whole new social experience, which would be, in more ways than one, for them, and for those who read the narrative now, an eye-opener. At any rate, the party headed for the Holy Land, more or less along the coast, through the delta of the River Nile. Among other things, they confronted Islam, which had come to dominate pretty well the whole of North Africa and large areas of the Middle East. Now, it should be borne in mind that there were dangers both from thieves and robbers and also from diseases. The party happened to set out on their trip. When they set out on their trip, a plague was affecting many parts of the Middle East, probably seemed to be the bubonic plague. I'll come to this again when they come into Europe. But they hit Alexandria when there was a plague going on. Besides this, they were coming in touch with unfamiliar cultures and animals and therefore alien bugs and bacteria and food and water and so on. And for this, they were essentially unprepared. No inoculations or any other such remedies. The truth is that they went out like Abraham, not knowing where they were going, what they were facing, and even in Europe, which in many places was rent by social and political unrest, apart from things like the bubonic plague. But then they were men like us. Is it like us? Of strong faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And therefore their reliance is upon him in all their trials and uncertainties. And this trip that they took would prove it. Basically, I think these men faced and endured, what they faced and endured was beyond belief. By our modern standards, no motor vehicles, no public conveniences, roughing it in tents was the order of the day, at least in the Middle East. No universally respected Sabbath rest, even in the European countries through which they travelled. These were tough experiences, though through which really only Andrew Bonner, for the greater part, came through unscathed. Although there are accounts of him being sick in various places, which is not surprising. It appears to have been especially hard on the older men, though they soldiered on quite admirably. So it was while they were crossing the Nile Delta, 10 days into their journey, that the accident occurred of Dr. Black falling from his camel. One unfamiliar feature of these travels for these men was the sheer heat they faced. It was often 90% in the shade, and as they were going from Alexandria towards Palestine, they were facing the sun, and it was hard for them. Riding this way produced it is said, an irresistible drowsiness, which seems to have overcome Dr. Black at that point when he fell from his camel. The others rushed to his aid and did what they could, but he soon recovered well enough indeed the following Sabbath to preach before an interesting congregation comprising in the tents the governor, seated on, as he said, our best carpet in the corner of the tent, the men themselves and Bedouins gathered around the tent door. In this occasion, Black incidentally preached in Italian. He preached in Italian, and one of the appointed helpers, one Ibrahim, acted as interpreter into Arabic, I presume. Now, although the fall from the camel was not, in fact, the decisive incident in Black's later withdrawal from the Holy Land, he had shown some vulnerability in the face of trying conditions, and the roughing it was clearly a factor. Although they often had local help, the travellers had a fair bit of physical work to put in as they went along, something for which I dare say Doctors Black and Keith were ill-prepared and ill-suited. Well, the party came towards the border of Palestine at El Arish on 30th of May. The following day they were in the Promised Land, and on their first Lord's Day in Palestine on June the 2nd, 1839, they gladly sang together in one of their tents the strains of Psalm 76. In Judah's land, God is well known, his name's in Israel great. In Salem is his tabernacle, in Zion is his seat. Now, after a few days' delay, whilst the camels were obtained, the party then began to trek towards Jerusalem, which they finally reached on the 7th of June after a long and weary ride of 7 hours. McChain, the narrative tells us, dismounting from his camel, hurried forward on foot over the rocky footpath till he gained a point where the city of the Lord comes first in sight. Soon all of us were on the spot, silent, buried in thought, and wistfully gazing on the wondrous scene where the Redeemer died. At that moment, we were impressed chiefly by the fact that we were now among the mountains that are round Jerusalem. And half unconscious that it was true, we repeated inwardly the words, "Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem." Well, their first night in Jerusalem was the 8th of June. It was spent on the stone floor of apartments in Mount Acra. "We spread our mats on the cool stone floor," writes Bonner, "hoping for a night of calm repose, but our rest was broken and uncomfortable in the extreme, our rooms being infested with vermin, a kind of trial which travellers in the East must make up their mind frequently to undergo." The party were not impressed with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, reputedly built on the site of Calvary and the tomb. Wrote McChain, "Calvary is the only place about Jerusalem which yielded nothing but pain and disappointment. My heart sickened at the view." I must say this was my own reaction visiting the site some 25 years ago. The Christianity witnessed there was, to the deputation, a far cry from the truth of the gospel they knew and loved. Well, notwithstanding the presence of the plague, the party risked visiting the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem. It was reckoned that there were around 5,000 Jews living in Jerusalem at the time, though only 80 or so lived in the Jewish quarter. They sought to engage with them, as they did with all the Jews they met, not only to be witnesses for Christ, but to gather information, as was their remit, about the whereabouts and concentration of Jews throughout Palestine and elsewhere. They visited the Kotel, the Western or Wailing Wall, where there are stones from the original Herodian temple. Their last day in Jerusalem, 18th June, they left with this thought: "May we never lose the feelings of intense compassion towards Israel, which these few days spent in Jerusalem awakened, and never rest till all the faithful of the Church of our fathers have the same flame kindled in their hearts." Well, moving northward from Jerusalem, the travellers arrived at Sychar, You know, it was at Sychar. Andrew Bonner was especially keen to see the famous Jacob's Well. And the well was covered with a low arched stone structure. And as he stooped to enter, his pocket Bible fell from his vest pocket and disappeared down the well with a splash. The little Jewish boy accompanying him was not hopeful. "Ah," he says, "the well is deep." And these were the same words the Samaritan woman had used speaking to Jesus 1800 years earlier. Bonner gave it up as lost, his pocket Bible. However, 4 years later, a missionary on his way to India, Dr. John Wilson, passing that way, he was Free Church then, passing that way en route to India, persuaded, that is to say paid, a young Samaritan called Jacob to be lowered 75 feet on a rope to try to recover the Bible, of which he had read in the narrative, you see, in 1842. Behold, it was recovered. The water damaged, but it was brought back to Scotland, where it now forms the part of a collection in New College, Edinburgh. A Protestant icon. Continuing through Samaria, the party headed for Haifa, having found no Jewish communities in the hills of Samaria. From Haifa, they were detained by quarantine. Because Haifa was under quarantine on account of the plague, they were detained there for a fortnight. And from Haifa, they sailed to Beirut. Taking stock of their journey at Beirut, it was decided to go back to Galilee to inquire about the presence of Jews in Tiberias. There were reputed to be 1,200, and in Safed, 2,000 of them. However, at Beirut, it was agreed that Dr. Black, who had, quote, felt the climate of Syria and the rude manner of the travelling too much for his bodily strength, it was agreed that he should proceed homeward via Constantinople and that Dr. Keith should accompany him. And they set sail, 3 o'clock, July 7, after a forenoon service in a commodious room in which Dr. Black preached on Romans 5:1. The return visit of Bonner and McChain in these days that followed confirmed to them the suitability of Tiberias and Safed as possible locations for Jewish mission work. Palestine at that time, however, was greatly troubled by marauding Bedouin. Palestine has been troubled pretty well in every generation, hasn't it? Well, it was troubled then by marauding Bedouin, making it unsafe, rather unsafe for missionary community. A couple of years later, Bonner and McChain were forced to admit this, that though it was ideal for a mission, that it was not ready for it. But Free Church Jewish mission work was, however, established later, both in Tiberias in 1884 and in Safed in 1895. So that was the journey from Britain to Palestine. Secondly, the journey in Europe itself. Bonner and McChain duly made their way back to Beirut, arriving there after reconnoitering Tiberias and Safed, Galilee. They made their way back to Beirut in arriving 20th of July. The next steamer for Smyrna, Izmir now and now Turkey, was not until the following week on the 28th. Though McChain had picked up a fever whilst waiting in Beirut, he was still suffering at Smyrna and remained there till well enough to go on to Constantinople. Meanwhile, on Saturday 17th August, Bonner, accompanied by a converted Christian Jew, Erasmus Kalman, who had been assisting them in their visits to Tiberias and Safed, he sailed with Kalman to Constantinople. There was in Constantinople a London Society of the Promotion of Christianity among the Jews, work among a considerable Jewish community in Constantinople. It was reckoned that there were as many as 80,000 Jews in Constantinople and in the surrounding villages. And it was clear to Bonner that this was a real possibility for Jewish mission work, though there would be problems because of the Ottoman government, because it gave the Jewish community official recognition and therefore the oppression or persecution of Christians was a real threat. On 26th August, another steamer arrived from Smyrna and McChain was on board. A few hours later, they sailed for the River Danube by way of the Black Sea. This took them into Wallachia and Moldavia. Moldavia, that's modern Romania. And modern Wallachia and Moldavia are modern Romania and Moldova, though the greater part of old Moldavia is now in Romania. Don't want to confuse you about this, but they were going in an area which was in modern Romania and not Moldova, if you could follow me. Well, Black and Keith had passed that way, but they had headed west from Bucharest along the Danube towards Budapest. It wasn't Budapest then, not till 1873. Buda, they were on opposite sides of the Danube, and there were no bridges across. They were heading towards Budapest and Vienna. Bonner and McChain chose to go north from Bucharest towards Jasy, that is J-A-S-S-Y, through Moldavia. Again, in this part of their travels, these men were faced with a quarantine situation. It was a 1,000-mile-long European anti-bubonic plague, cordon sanitaire, it was called. And John Ross commented that, quote, boarding the steamer, they had mistakenly thought that they had left behind the East and its privations and had come entirely unprepared for the primitive condition that now confronted them in the quarantine camp. So they were forced to disembark and spend a week in Galatz. In quarantine, they were confined, quote, to a large enclosure of wood with many wooden cottages in the centre, one of which was to be our place of confinement for a week. Just imagine it. We found the benefit, he says, with some resignation, we found the benefit of being inured to a rude life of those who dwell in tents. Shows some of the hardships that these men had to endure on this trip. Well, after the period of their quarantine, the British Vice Consul in Galatz provided a carriage to take them to Jasy, J-A-S-S-Y, from Bucharest, some miles west of Galatz. Bonner and McChain came to place great importance on Jasy, devoting many pages of their narrative to an account of the burgeoning Jewish community there. It accounted for around 50% of the total population of the city. However, there too they faced potential problems through the presence of Orthodox churches, Greek Orthodox Church particularly. It is said that if they succeeded in converting to evangelical faith a single Orthodox Christian, that act would be fatal to the mission and every door would be immediately shut to Protestant missionaries. Well, from Wallachia and Moldavia, Bonner and McChain passed through Austria, or Austrian Poland, as it was then. The Bible tells us there is nothing new under the sun. Think of the experiences of these men in Austria. There was, of course, the quarantine situation with the fumigations. There was the medical concerns. They were another thing. More serious was the clear attempt to eliminate Christianity. Well, they're in Europe now. And Europe is bent on eliminating Christianity in 2018, isn't it? The government's religious intolerance, comments Ross, made them feel extremely unwelcome and left them with the option that the Austrian Empire was a realm where ignorance and superstition led souls to hell in peaceful, unresisting compliance. But there were physical dangers as well, as McChain found out in Zlokso, I'm not sure about that, Z-L-O-C-Z-O-W, in modern Poland. On a quietly spent Lord's Day, McChain went for a walk. At one quiet spot, he sat down and read in the scriptures, only to be set upon by two shepherds, bent on robbery. And there followed a scuffle between them, a physical struggle. McChain was quite athletic, actually. And it was a physical struggle between McChain and these two men. He did marvellously well. And this lasted for a quarter of an hour. And the would-be robbers just ran off, leaving an rather exhausted McChain, who just about had enough strength to return to his colleagues. That was on October the 6th. 5 days later, they were at Krakow in Poland, modern Poland. And there they were impressed with Krakow as a potential centre for evangelical and mission Jewish mission work, because at that time there were thought to be 22,000 Jews in a population of some 49,000. Now again, though, there was potential for antagonism from Catholic authorities. Crossing from Austria to Prussia, they arrived at Poznan, modern Poland, where there were apparently 73,000 Jews, and the city seemed to offer great possibilities, potential for mission, opportunities for mission work. It was already the location of schools established and supported by the Edinburgh Ladies Association on behalf of Jewish females. The only other stop the travellers made was in Berlin, from where they hurried homewards via Hamburg and arrived in London on November the 6th. In all the adventure for these men, 6 months. As the narrative makes clear, the trip was a kaleidoscope of ever-changing scenes and experiences and interesting people met with opportunities for sharing the gospel with the Jews and others, and the developments of friendships along the way. It was indeed the trip of a lifetime, during which careful records were kept apropos the purpose of their mission to identify possible locations for Jewish mission work in the Middle East and Europe. Then there is thirdly the part of the journey of what happened to Dr. Black and Dr. Keith. To all intents and purposes, Drs. Black and Keith were simply going to be heading home through Europe, all the while, quote, making inquiries into the condition of the Jews in all the most important places through which that route would take them. As it was, after reaching Bucharest, the men followed the River Danube through Budapest, or to Budapest. An illness to Dr. Keith detained him at Pest. The Danube, the way the Danube flows, Buda, B-U-D-A, was on the left bank of the Danube, and Pest, P-E-S-T-H, was on the right bank. There were no bridges at that point across the River Danube between these two places. So the illness of Dr. Keith detained him at Pest till the following spring, that is to say 1840, whilst Dr. Black detained him in Vienna for some months. They both arrived home very much later than the younger men. But their travels were not in vain, and in many respects, they were more crucial and lasting than the others, though precious little is precisely known about their inquiries. Providentially, it turned on the illness of the Scottish ministers and the productive friendship between Dr. Keith and the 42-year-old Archduchess Maria Dorothea Louise Wilhelmina Caroline of Württemberg. Her date, 1797 to 1855, incidentally. She was the wife of Archduke Joseph Palatine of Hungary. Now, Maria Dorothea was a Lutheran, and she'd been turned back to the Bible, we're told, by the death of her son 2 years earlier. And it was the Bible, she said, in which she met with Jesus. Now, in those days, the city of Buda, where the palace was on the west bank of the Danube. The Pest, as I mentioned, was in the east. As yet, no bridge, okay? There was no bridge, though one was being designed and was beginning to get underway. And in actual fact, the construction of it was down to a Scottish builder, engineer called Adam Clark, by the way. Arriving at Pest, as they waited for the passage to Vienna, Black and Keith realised that this was a more promising city for Jewish mission work than the others they had visited. The problem was that the Roman Catholic religion held sway and was intolerant of other faiths. From where would such help come to establish a mission in a relatively safe conditions? The answer was the Archduchess Maria Dorothea, who lived in an impressive palace on the Buda side of the Danube. She had a heart of the gospel, a heart for the gospel to be taken to the 100,000 or so inhabitants of Hungary's city capital. Meantime, the Scotsman had fallen ill with typhus, picked up from, commonly from, the sewage in the Danube, which became hazardous, we are told, to summer travellers. How much more are they going to endure, these men? Well, how would we do these days? Keith's condition was particularly bad, and it looked for a while that there was little hope for recovery, but recover he did. The deputation had taken letters of introduction to facilitate appointments with people of influence, and this came to the attention of Maria Dorothea, who had recently received a copy of Keith's Evidences of Prophecy from her husband, Archduke Joseph. How's that? She visited Keith as he was recovering and even contributed to nursing him back to health. In due time, a real friendship developed, leading to the Jewish mission in Pest. Interesting providences. Keith questioned the legality of this venture with Maria Dorothea. And he says, he questioned the legality of it. And she stated bluntly that should the Church of Scotland see fit to begin the work, she would place herself between the mission and whatever official threats might harass it. Keith was later to write, in that feeling, involved as it was with many coincidences, which it was not man that directed and overruled, lay the key whereby a door was to be opened for the Jewish mission in Pest, though no one knew it or thought of it then. Keith and Black gradually recovered. Early in November, Black, who had been keen to return home as soon as possible, travelled on to Vienna, but was not fit enough to return immediately. He did eventually return via Frankfurt and Rotterdam, but arrived home after Bonner and McChain. As for Keith, he was so ill, it was thought prudent for somebody to go out and accompany him back. His son George went out. He was a medical student in Edinburgh at the time. He went out to be with his father and to bring him back. Father and son remained in Pest until the winter was past, returning to London via Munich and Brussels and Antwerp, arriving home pretty well a year after they had left, April 1840. Maria Dorothea, incidentally, sent them away with a large hamper of food. The hamper contained a silver spoon with the archducal crest, and it remains in the collection in New College, Edinburgh, another Protestant icon. Okay. Thus ended, with Keith's return in April 1840, thus ended the commission of the deputation charged to inquire about the Jews and to suggest possible locations for mission work. What they reported back certainly gave the church much to ponder. And I've just got two other parts to do. And the first is this, the consequences. Come to the consequences after this travelogue. The consequences, the outcome of the work and its fruit. Several points here. The consequences of the mission of inquiry were far-reaching. Decisions weren't easy to make, however. There were two issues to be faced relating, first of all, to personnel and secondly, to locations. Who was going to do it? Where were they going to go? These were the issues. As to personnel, Robert Woodrow in 1840 drew attention of the committee to the willingness of one recognised Hebraist to offer himself to the work somewhere. Reverend John Duncan, 1796-1870, well known to you all, Rabbi Duncan, then the minister of Milton Church in Glasgow, was the man in question. This offer was readily accepted by this committee, and on May 16, 1841, he was publicly, I think the way to put it is, he was publicly designated to this new, as yet unspecified work as a missionary to the Jews. He was the first man appointed as missionary to Jews by the Church of Scotland, though he wasn't settled anywhere. He was not, however, the first active missionary on the ground. That privilege fell to a probationer who was ordained to the work on the 7th of March, 1841. This was Daniel Edward, 1815 to 1896. Daniel Edward. After doing this work, I have a very soft spot for Daniel Edward, for reasons that have become clear. He was a native of Edinburgh. Well, that's enough. John Ross has correctly stated that although less will be remembered of Edward by posterity than Duncan, it was Edward who was the true pioneer of the General Assembly's mission to the Jews, which may come as a surprise to us. That's the personnel, initially. I'm only dealing about consequences initially, because otherwise we could get into another 6 months. Locations. As to locations, though there was some concern, in the committee with the work to locate in Palestine, in 1841 it was eventually decided the mission centre should be located at Iași, J-A-S-S-Y, Iași, in modern Romania, then in Moldavia, now Romania, and in Pest. So Iași and Pest. Edward was appointed to the work in Iași, along with a converted German Jew called Hermann Philipp. Pest would be John Duncan's designated station, and he would be accompanied, he had a lot of help, he would be accompanied by Reverend William Allen and Robert Smith, both of whom were ordained in 1842, and they were joined by a former businessman who was an enthusiast for Jewish mission work, William Wingate. He was ordained in Pest in 1843. Allen, incidentally, was married to a stepdaughter of John Duncan, and Wingate married his daughter, that is to say, by his first wife. But these women joined him, Allen, Smith and Wingate. When the disruption occurred in the Church of Scotland in 1843, all these missionaries threw in their lot by conviction with the emergent Free Church of Scotland and continued in the various spheres of labour among the Jews. And it was the disruption of May 1843 that brought an end to John Duncan's work in Pest, as he was elected to the chair of Hebrew and Old Testament in the Free Church College in Edinburgh in the first Free Church Assembly. Now, the Free Church of Scotland, which took over the Jewish mission work in the Church of the Church of Scotland, must have been one of the most mission-conscious churches in the 19th century or any century. Certainly, as far as Jewish mission work was concerned, besides the missions in Pest and Iași, which were established, there were also established Jewish missions in Constantinople in 1845, Breslau in 1852, Amsterdam in 1862, and I mentioned Tiberias in 1884 and Safed in 1895 in the Holy Land. Many Jews were converted through the labours and prayers of these men. And normally one thinks of Pest and the work of John Duncan, initial work of John Duncan, the effect of the gospel on the Safiers, and Alfred Edersheim was converted, Adolf Safier. They became very well known by all their written works, some of which you will have in your bookshelves and are still valuable to read. Though the impact of Duncan was profound in, frankly, more promising situation than Edward faced in Iași, he was only 2 years in Pest, whereas Edward devoted a lengthy ministry of 54 years to Jewish mission work in various European locations, Iași, Lemberg and Breslau. He was a thoroughly conservative churchman, brethren, thoroughly conservative churchman. In 1852 assembly, with reference to the end of the work in Lemberg, before he moved on to Breslau, he wrote that the door has been kept longer open than I ever thought it would be, and now the man of sin has prevailed to get it closed more jealously than before. Writing in 1862, Alexander Moody Stuart, another great hero of mine in the Old Free Church, was to comment that, quote, his work, Edward's work, is undervalued at home. Nothing in connection with our mission to the Jews ever so exceeded my hopes as our mission situation in Breslau. Mr. Edward is a Scotchman with all our Calvinistic theology, a Hebrew of the Hebrews with his whole heart bent on the conversion of the children of Israel. And more recently, Lionel Richie noted that, quote, Edward was a conservative of conservatives, for he remained utterly opposed to the tendencies of modern German biblical scholarship. Incidentally, in visiting Breslau in 1891, another minister, James Wells, witnessed Edward conduct an old-fashioned Scottish service without, of course, instrumental music, in a city worm-eaten with rationalism, and where few darken a church door, I saw a large hall filled with devout worshippers. Daniel Edwards in 1891. My dear friends, he is an unsung Scottish missionary hero. Remember the name. On the first Friday of the General Assembly of the Free Church of Scotland, on the 22nd of May 1896, according to custom, the evening was given over to the consideration of the report of the Jewish Committee. That particular evening, an aged minister, who had devoted himself to the Jewish mission work since his ordination in 1841, tottered to the platform to address the assembly. This was Daniel Edward, now an octogenarian. Through ill health, he'd finally laid aside the work among the Jews in Breslau the previous year. His appearance was said to be picturesque and apostolical. I'd like to have been there to see that. Know what it was to be picturesque and apostolical. I'm not sure we're very picturesque, or it could be picturesque, but I'm not sure about apostolical. He was greeted with a standing ovation. Apparently, he gave stirring address, in response to which there was deafening applause. It was one of his final public acts in this world, as just 3 weeks later, he passed to his eternal reward. But here was a missionary who was involved in the mission work amongst the Jews from its inception, following the initial mission of inquiry to the Jews in 1839 under the auspices of the Church of Scotland. Just a few, you've been very patient, and I've been lengthy. A few concluding thoughts. I've got the perfect seven. There are various inspiring lessons, I think, can be drawn from the mission of inquiry to the Jews undertaken by this deputation in 1839. First of all, the first thing relates, my dear friends, I would say, to the exemplary spirit of these men. They were ready and prepared to go out and about wherever they went to speak to people about the Saviour, to pass on tracts and booklets that spoke eloquently of their passion for the gospel of redeeming grace. And it is a challenge to us. The second thing is, there is a clear evidence in all that they did of the exercise of faith and utter reliance upon the Lord. And it all seemed to be uncomplaining as they stepped into this unknown physical, climatic and social situation, these conditions for which they were, frankly, largely unprepared. Their election was known by their work of faith, labour of love and patience of hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. We also remember them with thanksgiving. Thirdly, what is clear also is their courage and endurance in the face of adversities. They faced real dangers to life and limb, and they endured as faithful soldiers of Jesus Christ. We bear in mind, in relation to health matters, that they had only the most basic, we would say less than basic, medical supplies and remedies for who knew what illnesses might bring them down. Fourthly, these men were bright and shining lights, my dear friends, as men of prayer and nearness to the Lord in what they face. This they clearly showed a spiritual frame of heart and mind. Fifthly, it's clear that they proved that the Lord is gracious when you think of how the labours of these men were evidently not in vain in the Lord. I'm not excluding here, I'm not just speaking about the four men, I'm speaking about the men that went to Pest, the men that went the men that went to Yash as well. They were not in vain in the Lord. Sixthly, it helps focus our minds and hearts upon God's ancient people to have a heart concern for their conversion and to keep alive the vision initiated in the Scottish Church in 1838. And this, finally, all must serve as a stimulus to us, dear friends, to be engaged and diligent in the work of the gospel with prayerfulness and utter reliance upon the Lord, who, after all, as we profess, is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we can ask or think. According to what? According to the power of man? No, according to the power that works in us. To him be the glory, but in the church by Christ Jesus through all ages, world without end. Thus endeth the account of the mission of inquiry to the Jews in 1839 and its consequences. Thank you for your patience in this.